Good morning. This morning we're starting a new series. I know we didn't get the marquee changed out, but we are starting a new series on using examples to influence us, especially the examples of the apostles themselves. We'll be going through and looking at the lives of the apostles and using these men as examples for us to follow. Along with the examples of the apostles, we'll use some other even more modern examples to follow. If you go back to Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, the scripture reading this morning, "Therefore, since we are surrounded with such a great cloud of witnesses..." Now, the witnesses in Hebrews, if he goes back to chapter 11, and he goes back to Abel and Noah and Abraham, Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, all the what we might consider the great people of the Old Testament. And he says, these people surround you and their lives is a witness. By a witness, he's not talking about sometimes the way that we use that term. We sometimes say that we witness to Christ, some people what Jesus does in our life. That's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about a witness of their lives by what they did. Very objective, nothing subjective about this. He says, by faith, these people live the type of life that we need to live. And by that, they surround us and they give us that example. And so he brings out them as an example to us. He said, let us lay aside every weight and every sin which clings so closely, anything that keep hold us down, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Now, I want you to think about, as we go through this, each one of us has a different race set before us. He's not talking about us as a congregation or a people of God, the race set before us. He's talking about you as a person. God has a plan for your life, and he wants you to hold to that race, that plan that he has for you, the purpose that he's laid up for you as an individual. Each one of us, God has a plan for us. And that's what the author of Hebrews says. Remember these people, they didn't have it easy. You go back and look at chapter 11, and even though these were the people of God, that God was with them, their lives weren't always easy. He even goes down to the very end, how many actually were martyred. One was sawed in two, we believe the prophet Isaiah, and others that were put to death for their faith. They didn't live an easy life, but they held to that race. And then he goes down and gives us, looking to Jesus, the final example that he gives us, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the very cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. And so as we go through these examples, we're taking a look at these men that set an example, and there were women there too that set an example for us as Christians. But I'd like to start with a couple more modern examples. If you had to think about, or somebody asked you, who are the three greatest scientists of all time? Now, we might get a couple different perspectives on that, but I just finished reading a book where this person went through what he believed were the three greatest physicists or physical scientists of all time. And the first one he came up with was one that you might think about, Isaac Newton. Now, Isaac Newton lived a few hundred years ago, and if you pick up a modern physics book today, either in high school or college, you'll find the first two-thirds of it are devoted to work that Isaac Newton started. It basically Newtonian mechanics and optics and the law of gravity. And you can just go on and on the things that Isaac Newton brought to us. One author put down that he was one of the most influential people that have ever lived. Now, I'm not... You know, you can maybe back that up a little bit. But Isaac Newton, in all the writings that he did on mathematics, he wrote more about theology and his belief in God than he did mathematics. And I want to share with you a couple quotes from him, and some of these ideas we will be developing more as we go through. The first one, "The most beautiful system of the sun and the planets and the comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." In those few words, that's basically why he believed in God. And in many ways, that's why I believe in God. If you go back to Romans chapter 1 and verse 20 that we looked at last week, or a few weeks back, where Paul says, you can just look at the creation, and you know by looking at this creation all the things around us, there must be a God behind it all. And that's what Isaac Newton is saying. But the next quote, too, is one we'll be taking a look at and thinking about as we go through. Gravity explains the motion of the planets, but it cannot explain who sets the planets in motion. God governs all things and knows all things that can be done. And I think this is one of the ideas that we sometimes fall down on. We sort of think, doesn't science tell us everything? And science does tell us a lot. And that's what he says. I can write you an equation for gravity. Newton did that. He wrote the equation that this is how gravity works. But he says, I can't tell you why it works or where it came from. That comes from God. And see, science only gives us what we might call the upper edge. What everything below it. Where does it come from? What's the purpose of it? That's what Newton says. He said, I can describe it for you. I can give you an equation to calculate gravity, but I can't tell you why or where it came from or what the purpose of it is. He says, that comes from God. And that's where Isaac Newton gives us that idea. So when people start looking at scientists and say, well, if you're a scientist, you don't need God, men like Isaac Newton disagreed with that. He lived at a time of what was called the Enlightenment. And in that time in European history, there were a lot of great philosophers and great scientists, and they had this idea that they could just about do away with even needing God. And it's that same kind of idea of science that we see around us today. One writer put it like this. Robert Boyle, who was also one of the great scientists of all time, and some would call him the father of modern chemistry, Robert Boyle and Isaac Newton were early members of the Royal Society. They were religious men who repudiated the skeptical doctrines of the Enlightenment of their time. They familiarized the minds of their countrymen with the idea of law in the universe and the scientific method of inquiry to discover truth. It was believed that these methods would never lead to any conclusions inconsistent with biblical history and the miraculous religion of Christianity. Newton lived and died in that faith. And that's where I think we sometimes let ourselves be dragged away. There are men that we can look up to, great scientists, and know that the belief in God is reasonable and rational and that the creation shows us that belief. I'd like to show you the next one. If you had to name the three greatest, this particular person named, we're going to only go through two of these today, and next week we'll hit on some more of them. The second one he brought out was James Clerk Maxwell. Now, he may not be as familiar with you, Clerk Maxwell, as you are with Isaac Newton. But James Clerk Maxwell came up with the laws or a series of equations that define electricity or light, radio waves. Basically, all the electronics that you have is traced back to work that Maxwell did. And some say that his set of equations are some of the greatest equations man has ever thought out. And I'd like to show you just this little tongue-in-cheek. This was on a T-shirt when I was in college. And God said, let there be light. And he said, Maxwell's equations. So that's a little tongue-in-cheek. But this is the differential form. If you really want to go into the calculus side of it, there's an integral form. And one of the things that Newton did, as we got through Newton, he was the founder of calculus as well. And I know all of you, when you went through college, just loved calculus. So you got Newton to thank for that. But this is the differential forms of Maxwell's equations. And they do completely define light. And one of the ideas that we're also developing in this series, the very fact that we can describe our universe in a set of simple little equations is really a magnificent thing. There are some scientists that have brought that down. That's the reason they believe in God. That you can see such order in our universe that you can describe something as complex as light with just a few simple little equations. You see that the order and design that went into our universe, and that points to a designer for that universe. And we'll see that idea more even next week as we look at some of the ideas of some of the great scientists. James Clerk Maxwell was an elder in the Church of Scotland towards the end of his life. He was always very active. Now, I'd like to show you a couple of the things that he said. The first one is, Think what God has determined to do with all those who submit themselves to His righteousness and are willing to receive the gift, the eternal life in Jesus Christ. They are conformed to the image of His Son. And when that is fulfilled, God sees that they are conformed to the image of Christ. There can be no condemnation. Very similar to what Paul says, of course, in Romans chapter 8. But the idea, Maxwell was a strong believer in God all of his life and a strong, active worker in the Church of Scotland where he lived. I'd like to show you another quote from him because this goes into a lot of things that hit us today. A few years back, I read a book, and one of the authors in it had been asked, did he believe that Genesis chapter 1 conformed to science? And his reply was, what science? The science of today? The science of 50 years ago? The science of 50 years from now? And Maxwell was sort of hit with the same idea. One of the person at the same time Maxwell lived was Darwin in this series of evolution. And they asked him, did he believe in the theory of evolution? And this is what he replied. And I think it's a very good thought for us today. He said, the rate of change of scientific hypotheses or theories is naturally much more rapid than those of biblical interpretation. So if an interpretation is found such that the hypothesis, it may help keep that hypothesis above ground long after it ought to be buried and forgotten. What he's saying is scientific theories sort of come and go. And if you try to link those into the Bible and try to interpret the Bible with the modern theory, when that modern theory has been discarded, then what do you have? You may have kept it above ground, as he said, or kept it alive longer than it should be. The Bible is constant. It doesn't move. Science, we learn more and more every day. You don't pick up a newspaper that you don't read about some new discovery or some new something that's happening. And that's what Maxwell is saying. He says, be careful what you believe, because these things kind of come and go. But God's Word, it's constant. You don't. It's not going to move for you. But science will always be changing. And so be careful what you believe and what you hold on to. And there's an awful lot of examples of that where people have taken scientific theories and tried to link them to the Bible only to find those scientific theories or disprove them later on. And so what do they do? How do they link them to the Bible? Sort of discredits both ideas. The third example we'd like to look at today is James, the son of Zebedee, one of the apostles of Jesus. If you go through the apostles, he's one that's always mentioned second in the list. When it lists through the apostles of Jesus, we read through the list, it usually has Simon or Peter first, and then James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, James, to whom he, that is Jesus, gave the name Sons of Thunder. Now, we don't know exactly why James was given this title, but it sort of appears in Luke chapter 9, they had an example that may be the reason. In chapter 9 of Luke, it's right before Jesus sends the apostles out on what's sometimes called the limited commission. He sends the apostles out to teach the coming of the kingdom. It's one of the ways we know that the apostles understood what the kingdom that Jesus had been teaching them for 3 years, because he sends them out to teach the coming of the kingdom. But when he sends them out, they're not accepted everywhere, and that's brought out in Luke chapter 9. He says, when the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face toward Jerusalem, that is Jesus. And he sent messengers ahead of him who went and entered the village of the Samaritans to make preparations for him. But the people did not receive him because his face was set towards Jerusalem. And when his disciples James and John saw it, they said, Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven and consume them? But he rebuked them. Now, we don't know exactly what they had in mind. Maybe it's just because they felt like Jesus had been slighted and they felt like they had to stand up for him. And they know this has happened in the Old Testament, that fire came down from heaven. So maybe, you know, this would be a good thing for Jesus to do to verify who he was. But one of the things we see with James is he was outspoken. I mean, he's one that, you know, let's get this done, Jesus. Let's show these people who we are. I mean, James was one of those. We sometimes put that with Peter, but we see that with James too. James is always referred to as the son of Zebedee. And that too tells us a lot about him. If you go through the New Testament, you notice Jesus is usually referred to as Jesus of Nazareth, where his town was. Only once or twice has he ever mentioned Jesus, son of Joseph, because most of the time we think, most likely, Joseph had died by the time Jesus really starts his ministry. And plus, Joseph was probably very nondescript, not somebody very famous, other than right around Nazareth or in Galilee. But James is always referred to as James, son of Zebedee. And so we believe Zebedee must have been somebody of great influence, somebody that people knew about. And so James most likely was at a fairly high social level at that time. Being son of Zebedee, we know he owned his own fishing boat and his own fishing company. It's always James and John. James is always mentioned first, so we think he was the older of the two sons and would have been probably inherited the family business at the death of their father. So James was most likely at a fairly high social status at that time, and one that was very prominent. Later on at the crucifixion, we know that John knew the high priest. And so James, being the older brother, most likely knew the high priest too. Or to move on the level at that time of the high priest and knowing the men of Sanhedrin, I mean, he was a person of a fair prominence. And we see this through his life, that he was a man of prominence. He was a man that was sort of well known at that time. And if you go through, there's a number of times in which we read the scriptures of Peter, James, and John. They form sort of an inner three right around Jesus. They were the ones that were closest to him, closest ones that he confided in, and we see this as we go through. At the very beginning of the ministry, one of the examples given is Jesus raises the daughter of Jairus from the dead. And he takes Peter, James, and John up to the upper room and raises this young girl that had been dead. The people were already singing like at her funeral, and he raises her from the dead. One of the great examples is that the transfiguration itself. Towards the end of Jesus' ministry, Jesus takes Peter, James, and John, just these three, and he goes up on top of a mountain. And there it says he's transfigured before him. His clothes are whiter than white. It's like he glows. And Moses and Elijah come down and talk to him. Now, it's hard to even imagine how you would have felt if you'd seen something like that. If you'd seen Jesus, who you'd lived with for 3 years, all of a sudden he changes his appearance. And he's transfigured, and you start getting a glimpse of his heavenly glory. Not just his glory, but then Moses and Elijah, two great of the people of the Old Testament you had heard about all your life, like we have, they came down and talked to him. It's almost like, you know, how would you feel? And that was James. He was one of the three that was with Jesus. But in chapter 10 of Mark, we see another side of James. He had been up with Jesus at the mountain. He was one of the prominent disciples, always there with Jesus. And he makes a request of Jesus. And it's really a very selfish request. It says, James and John, the son of Zebedee, came up to him, that is Jesus, and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." Now, that in itself it kind of leads you to, you know, what's going on here. Have you ever had one of your children come up to you and say, "We want you to do whatever we ask"? Well, you're pretty much on the defensive already. I mean, not many of us would just give in to that. And Jesus doesn't. He says, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant that one of us will sit on your right hand and one on your left when you come in your glory." Now, we don't know exactly what they had in mind. When you come in your glory, we know they understood the kingdom. As we already mentioned, Jesus had always sent them out to teach the coming of the kingdom. And in Mark chapter 4, verse 11, it says, "Unto you," talking to the 12 disciples, "has been given the secrets of the kingdom." So we know Jesus had taught them about the kingdom for 3 years. They understood that. But they still wanted to be prominent positions when he comes in his glory. Now, I don't know if that means when the kingdom would come with the church, or if they're looking at the time when Jesus comes in his final glory, when he comes in the air with all the angels and we get to rise up and meet him. That might be what they had in mind. But either way, they wanted a prominent position. And that's what speaks to us today. Because even today in the church, we still have the problem of people wanting to be more prominent than others and having a pecking order. And it's hard to get around that. Anytime you have any organization, we always have this little thing come into that organization called politics, where some people want something and somebody else wants a little bit more power than somebody else. And that's what Peter and John were. And that's where James was. That's where James and John, especially James, we're looking at today. That's where James. He wanted a position of prominence with Jesus. He wanted to be, Peter, James, and John are always right around Jesus. He wanted to submit that authority that he had with Jesus. But I want you to notice Jesus' reply to him. And it's a reply to him and then a reply to all of us. Jesus first turns to James and he says, "You know what you're asking? Are you able to drink the cup that I drink?" What he says to James is, "James, you really know what you want to be on my right hand and on my left hand? Are you able to live the type of life I'm going to live? Are you able to go through the suffering that I'm going to go through?" And James says to him, "Oh, yes, I am." And Jesus replies to him on over. He said, "Oh, yes, you will. You will be able to, but you don't really know what you're asking." But then he ends it with his reply to James and John and all the apostles and to us today. He says, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles, rulers in the world, lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and who would be first must be a slave to all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and give his ransom as a life for many." And that's one of the ideas that goes through all the apostles. Sometimes we have the idea in the scriptures that Peter was foremost among the apostles. But that really doesn't meet with the scriptures. It surely doesn't meet with this verse. The apostles, Jesus lowers them all down, or raises them all up, maybe is a better way to look at it. But they were all on the same plane. He says, "Who wants to be the greatest must be the lowest, must become the servant of all." And that's the idea we see through all the apostles. And that's an idea that we need to have ourselves. But we mentioned that Peter, James, and John were always closest to Jesus. And we see this at the very end of the Gospels. When Jesus goes after the Last Supper, last time he has a supper with all the apostles, he goes to the garden to pray because he knows he's going to the cross. He knows in just a few hours he's going to be on a terrible trial that's going to last all night, and he's going to be crucified within the next 24 hours. And he calls Peter, James, and John to go with him into the garden. And it's an amazing idea that what must have gone through their minds that night. And he went to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter, James, and John. These three, they'd been closest to him the whole time. And began to be greatly distressed and troubled. I mean, he was pouring out his heart to Peter, James, and John. And he said to them, "My soul is troubled," or very sorrowful, "even to the point of death. Remain here and watch." He wanted to go a little bit further and pray privately. And he does, and then he comes back. And what does he find? He finds his closest friends, those he depends on the most, asleep. And he said to Peter, he could have said to James or John, "Are you still asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour?" So here at the very end, this man that wants prominence, that wants that position of importance, that's had that all of his life, he lets the Savior down. He lets Jesus down when Jesus needed him. But Jesus had told him that he would drink the cup, that he would go the same path as Jesus. And we see that at the end of their lives. And we see that in Acts chapter 12. And here, if you had to name who was the foremost apostle, most of the time we'd say, well, Peter was the foremost apostle. But Herod didn't see it that way. About that time, Herod the king, this is 2 or 3 years now after the resurrection, the church has grown in Jerusalem, become quite powerful. He took violent hands and who belonged to the church, and he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. So who was that Herod looked to as the leader of the church? Herod looked to this man James. Now, it could have just simply been that James was still a very prominent person because of his background and his social standing. It may be that Herod actually knew James, and because James moved on the same level as the Sanhedrin and the high priest. For whatever reason, though, Herod, when he went to persecute the church, picked out James, and he had him put to death. And then he saw that made the Jews real happy, so he arrested Peter as well. Now, if you go through chapter 12, you know that the angel came and released Peter. James was killed. We don't know why the Lord allowed James to be killed, to be beheaded, and Peter to be rescued. But we see James fulfilling his role as an apostle. He gave his life even as Jesus gave his life. And we see that James, this man who wanted prominence, ended up laying down his life even as Jesus did. And he drank the cup that Jesus drank. He ran the race that was marked out for him. And that's what I want you to think today. We don't know what's going to come before us. James didn't know what was coming before him. But he ran the race that was marked out for him. And that's what we need to do. And remember that these people went on before and they ran that race. We live at a day and time where people look and say, well, you know, the science has disproven everything. But that's not true either. We need to keep firm our faith. And through that faith, just as these great men of faith, if you go back through Hebrews 11, it says, by faith, these men lived the type of life God wanted them to live. By faith, we too can live the type of life that God has marked out for us. We can run the race that's before us. The last scripture I'd like for you to share with you is Ephesians chapter 4. Here Paul says, you were taught with regard to your former way of life. And you can think back to James and his former way of life. To put off the old self, which is being corrupted by deceitful desires. The desires of this world are always around us. And to be made new in the attitude of your mind. To be put on a new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. We can be like God. We can conform to the image of God. We can put off the old way of life, this world, and put on a new way of life and truly run the race marked out for us. As we go through these examples, think about men like James. It wasn't easy for him always, and it wasn't easy for him at the end. But he lived a life according to God's plan and purpose for his life. And so we can too. And we can let these examples to know that the way we live is a rational, reasonable way to live according to science. And by faith, we can fulfill God's purpose in our lives. So think about that this week. And as we go through all of these examples, we're going to try to go through most of the apostles and look at the way that they lived and use these men as examples, and so that by faith they lived lives before God. By faith we can too. And faith truly is the victory in our lives. This morning, if you've never started your race with the Lord, there's not going to be a better time to start that race than today. To start your walk with Jesus, to be baptized into Him. And just as Jesus was put into the grave, you too will die to this world to be made a new life, to walk with Him in newness of life for all eternity. If you started that walk, but you haven't been faithful to it, why not come back to Him today? If you need to come in any way, won't you come? As together we stand and sing.